Be clear, when we ask questions, we're stopping the clock. Carla's being very diligent about that.
Just
preview
now.
For me so yeah, I can follow the argument.
The critical thing from a policy standpoint, the critical question is, how can you provide this public amenity and get it built by the private sector? And the challenge for the site is to create enough economic viability on the parts that are privately developed that it can carry the load, that it can pay for the public amenities. That's the balance challenge.
But again, I'm going to signal a little bit where I'm going to need some help here. We have a history of doing master planning for public spaces and plazas and then expanding them through the course of the development, not shrinking them. We expanded the footprint of the fields by working with the developer. We expanded the footprint for Director Park by extending the park to the lot line, so the entire plaza could be used for a public purpose. So, and I've had a hand in both. So I'm familiar with expanding the footprint to meet a public purpose. One of the concerns I have here is we're talking about shrinking a footprint.
All right,
and therefore, I think under the code, at least I'm going to have to be persuaded there's a compelling public benefit. Maybe that would be part of your presentation.
We accept that. That's our burden.
Okay.
But I want to be clear that the measurement here is not the 13,000 square feet that's been suggested, the argument being made that you're required to do 16,000, you're only doing 13. As you will see from our demonstration, the site, the square, is 16,000 square feet. It meets that standard. We're not reducing it in size.
Okay.
That's not part of the application.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Let Mr. Mitchell take over now.
Right. Thank you, Tim. For the record, Greg Mitchell, LRS Architects, 720 Northwest Davis, Portland, Oregon. Good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. I'd just like to say, first and foremost, just make sure that you've got everything in front of you and addresses the open space, and we're having a little bit of technical difficulty, so I can't open the electronic copy of this file, but I think you have in front of you an exhibit that looks somewhat like this. It has an illustrative that is in blue, and that what that indicates to you is the open space dedicated over with this development, and that it does, in fact, meet all the requirements of the master plan. Another general statement I would like to make as well at this time is that you also have a bound copy, and I'll only be referring to a few of the diagrams and content. I call this the Reader's Digest of the greater volume. These are excerpts directly out of our DR package. I don't think you guys wanted to read all the text in there, so we just pulled out the relevant pieces for you as reference. And again, I won't be touching on all those. Okay, general statement. At the time that LRS was brought in to design this project, it was our design team's mission to design this project to try to follow the master plan to the greatest extent possible. And where the master plan does not specifically address the issue, to use applicable sections of Title 33 of the Development Code. And in fact, we would actually be on the same side with the appellant as far as that is our guideline. We are to follow the master plan to the greatest extent possible. We're divergent is what's in the master plan and what is not. I would like to also thank the BDS staff for their 2+ year commitment to this project, and also the Design Review Commission for working constructively on a very difficult project. I'll now try to go item by item through the appellant's appeal. Open space. Again, the exhibit in for you. It's highlighted. Design meets or exceeds the master plan requirements and does address striking a balance. 2, scale of the building. The building conforms to the allowable FAR and is under the 77-foot height limit. It's actually 76 foot 6 inches to be technical, and the additional 10 feet of height was requested to activate the low roof and provide resident amenities, which were removed from the ground floor to add more retail commercial space fronting on the square and Northwest 21st as required in the master plan. 3, required commercial at the ground floor. The plan provides for active uses on 3 sides of the square as prescribed the master plan. Additionally, it meets the active use requirements on Northwest 21st, as outlined in the master plan. And contrary to what's inferred, the applicant is not using any trade-offs on the ground floor active uses to generate more FAR. Item 4, square connectivity and solar access. The square fronts on Northwest Pettigrove, as well as the portions of Northwest 21st, and provides direct access from the right-of-ways. The square is oriented to the south to take full advantage of the late morning and afternoon sun. You can't get much better open space orientation than a southern exposure here in the Pacific Northwest. Any other orientation of the square would be a compromise as to sun access in the course of the day and from winter to summer. Additionally, the plan provides for the east connection directly to the park from the square. While we did request a modification to the height of the opening, we were providing public art as a mitigation to that requirement. And to be clear, in addition to that, which we do not count as part of the square, there we are providing an arcade. So therefore, in our calculation that is actually in the DR package, it's also bound into within the exhibits contained here, is how we calculated and derived the full measure of the square, because it's not otherwise codified nor defined in the master plan. Quimby Festival Street. Festival Street is nowhere codified as to what it is. Basically, it's a non-standard street. The applicant met with the Northwest Neighborhood Association to discuss the aspects of this of the project. At the time of the design of the street, it did not seem to be an issue to them, but now it seems they have changed their minds. We also met with PBOT, which directed us to make changes to the design of the Quimby as to what was approved. I also should note that the master plan also delineates where you cannot access the site, which are basically the other two street frontages. So Northwest 21st could not be accessed, and we could not access, based on the master plan, from the south. Lively public realm is another item that they pointed to. Uncertain about Northwest Neighborhood's viewing on this. However, the design of the building and square provide for infinite flexibility to occupy the public spaces and host many events. The proposed retail spaces are designed to spill out on the square and activate the edges. Urban character. Again, not sure how you would design a building to meet all the requirements of the master plan and not have a project with urban character. The building fronts all public edges. Create active and transparent occupied spaces. Is built of quality and permanent materials. Provides pedestrian scaling elements through the use of canopies, overhangs, as well as arcade. Incorporation of live-work residential units fronting on the future park. Also, the massing and the architecture of the building responds to its contemporaries, such as the LL Hocking, Slabtown Marketplace, Q21 across the street, Slabtown Block 294 approved and under construction, as well as Block 295, and any future neighbors envisioned in the master plan. Item 8, building exceeds height and setback limitations. Well, you heard a lot about that. Other than the granted modifications for the 47 feet on the low building, as well as actually an 18-inch difference between what is actually codified. It's not story height, by the way, for clarification's sake. I think that they said it was so many stories that it's not how it's specified in the master plan. It's actually by feet. And it says that anything over 75 feet would require a setback or has to be no taller than 77 feet. We did solar studies, and we demonstrate that actually a building at 75 feet versus a building that's proposed is negligible on any kind of shading of the future park. Number 9, fails to provide required public spaces. Well, again, we are providing and we are going to be required to, as a part of this project, going through permitting and review, a access easement of 45 feet on the west boundary, a 60-foot easement on the north boundary for the Green Street, excuse me, for the Festival Street. So we comply. And the final item was just too much building, and I think we've hit on that far too many times. So I'd like, at this point, to turn over the microphone to Tom Brennecke.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Mayor Wheeler. My name is Tom Brennecke. I am with Guardian Real Estate Services. I'm the president of the company, property owner, and the property developer. Well, we're finally here. 39 months ago, we began what has turned out to be an extraordinary effort to obtain permits for Block 290 in the Conway Master Plan area. As previously highlighted by our professionals, we've gone above and beyond in an effort to create a feasible project that meets the requirements of the master plan. Significant efforts were made to work with Northwest District Association members to achieve a design that would be approved by the city and economically viable. We've employed two different design teams on the project and worked through many iterations of building plans. As our neighborhood advocates have often acknowledged, our challenge has been to put 7 pounds of sand in a 5-pound bag. As previously articulated, we firmly believe that the master plan's objectives and goals have been met. City staff agrees, and design review commissioners unanimously approved the design. The City Parks Department is fully supportive of the design, and Portland Housing Bureau is also supportive. Unfortunately, we will probably never agree with our opponents on such a subjective matter as what constitutes a successful public square. We've gone to great lengths, though, and are very proud of our final design. While we can debate heights, FAR, square footage, and amendments, I ask that you not allow the most pressing concern here to be lost in the conversation. Call it what you want, Portland has a housing shortage. We have a significant shortage of affordable housing, nowhere near enough to meet current or future demand. We intend to build 200 apartments right at the future streetcar stop and still leave 65% of the site open to the public. You already approved our multi-affordable housing proposal, and now 40 units are designated for households at or below 80% area median income. For those households, rents will be discounted 37 to 56%, representing $400 to $1,500 each month in rent.
For how long would that be?
The initial period is 10 years.
Thank you.
I urge you today to uphold the Design Commission's unanimous decision and finally allow us to move these apartments from the drawing board to the leasing office. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a few questions.
Commissioner Fish.
Mr. Ramos, first of all, thank you for bringing the backup documents, and I'm sorry about our technology, but it's an equal opportunity technology snafu. It just seems like every PowerPoint, every time we meet, doesn't work. So, but that's after the last upgrade we did, so maybe that was our mistake. When I'm standing on Northwest Pettigrove Street and I'm looking north on the eastern edge of the property, and you have designed a kind of a promenade that looks like a pedestrian-friendly promenade going north, and then it abuts the park. That's land owned by whom?
It is owned privately. It's not part of a public right-of-way now.
And so, but that would be dedicated to public right-of-way?
Yes, it'll be subject to a public easement allowing access, as we've discussed.
And that would be in perpetuity?
Yes.
Okay, and so that I mean, just from my point of view, that's a very attractive buffer, but that gives pedestrian access north-south at that on that side of the building.
Yes, right? It's designed to do that and designed to align with other north-south streets.
And can you state just succinctly for us again why inclusionary zoning does not apply to this project?
Yes, you have in a packet I've given to the clerk, which we can pass out now, a zoning opinion letter from the staff of the city, which makes the point that Ms. Adams made earlier, which is that within the area of the Conway Master Plan, the criteria that apply were vested in 2012. Since the city's requirements came in after that, they don't apply in this area.
So you're saying that this is a situation where a vesting occurred even before a developer submitted an application?
Well, the theory of the letter, and I think the legal status of it, is that the plan vested the criteria. So the critical date is back in 2012.
And this, you've handed us a legal opinion from the Bureau of Development Services?
What you have is...
Your letter.
No, this is not my letter. This is over the head, the letterhead of the City of Portland Bureau of Development Services.
So they have affirmed that view, that the vesting occurred in 2012, notwithstanding
yes.
the fact that no developer had submitted an application.
That's right.
And so, Mr. Ramos, how would you respond to the comment Mr. Michelson made that from his perspective, you start by designing the plazas, the parks, and the streets, and you build the structures to complement the public realm. And in his view, as I understood it, this process has taken the reverse approach. I want to give you a chance to respond.
Yes, I think that's a mischaracterization of the process. And Greg, of course, knows the process better than me, and I think he should respond. But the instruction that was given by Mr. Brenneke to the design team was follow the master plan. Meet those requirements. And if you can't then bring the process through the required filter of modifications and see if it passes muster. But the direction has been to start with the template created by the city in the plan, which has a park, which has the north-south access we're talking about, and has a square. Make that work.
I want to go back to IZ for a second. When was this project filed?
Just a second.
Yeah. Was it
2014?
2014. So prior to the adoption of our inclusionary zoning ordinance. So
correct.
You would argue
yes.
you would argue that on your exam for two grounds.
Correct.
One is that some entitlement may have occurred in 2012. Second, that that the filing occurred in 2014.
2016.
Pardon me? 2016?
It wasn't 2016. We've been 39 months at this. I'm sorry.
Prior to the effective date. Prior to the effective date.
Prior to the effective date.
But you're correct for two reasons.
And so the only risk that you have legally in this is if you had to file again, then there's a question about whether you're covered because it's a new application or whether you can still claim that the entitlement occurred in 2012.
Well, I think we would rely on the city's analysis to say that rules that apply are the 2012 rules.
So, Mr. Ramos, the difference between this project being subject to inclusionary zoning or housing and the multi-project is the difference between, say, 90 years of affordability for some 20% of the units, either on the site or off the site, or 10 years of tax abatements for 20% of the units being affordable, 80% AMI or lower. Now, did I state that wrong, Dan?
No, I think you got it right.
For 10 years. Yeah.
So there's a huge delta here. If this was an inclusionary housing proposal, we get roughly 9 times the covenant in terms of affordability. And they're baked in. And the consideration may be a little different. Under the multi-plan, what the applicant gets is a tax abatement, correct?
Yes.
And that's to the whole building or just to the units?
It's the value of the units, isn't it?
It's to the residential portion.
Just the residential, but the entire building.
The residential
so
portion.
So all the residential
building.
Units would be abated for 10 years in order to essentially get the public benefit of 20% of the units affordable to 80%
correct.
AMI. I think we all acknowledge there's a huge ravine between those two outcomes and in terms of public benefit. So if you're asking for changes to what the master plan would otherwise provide, does the council have the authority or the discretion to ask for an extension of the multi-program?
Well, the criteria are driven by what's in the code. You can always, of course, ask an applicant to go beyond the requirements of the code. So your question, do you have the ability to ask? Sure. And the applicant would have the ability to consider that. It's not something that can be imposed, in my view, but certainly it's a question that could be asked and
Has the applicant taken a position as to whether at the expiration of the initial 10-year period, he, it, she would be amenable to negotiating with the city a further extension?
I don't know that we've discussed that at this point.
Okay. Thank you.
So how does this relate to any of the decision-making criteria before us?
I was going to ask legal
counsel. I appreciate the discussion, but I'm just not sure it relates to our decision-making.
And that is my concern that we're – very interested in the line of questioning of Commissioner Fish, but I want to make sure we're staying on track with the record.
Well, they've asked for modifications, Mayor, to the master plan.
Correct.
That's a discretionary act, and we have the right to impose discretionary conditions on anything beyond what the master plan would otherwise provide. And since the Design Commission has rendered a decision that some changes are warranted based on the view that it better meets design overall design conditions, that's still a discretionary act. And my understanding is we have the right to set discretionary conditions on anything that alters the existing master plan.
The limitation on that law, which is you've generally stated, is that the condition has to relate directly to an approval criteria, and I think that's why.
Right. Well, I'd like to hear from our legal counsel on that. As good as you are, Mr. Ramos.
Yes.
No, Mr. Ramos is correct that the conditions of approval have to be geared towards the actual criteria. So one of the criteria here for a modification is, and I just closed the code, but it is, does it further a public benefit? Can you remind me exactly the language of the condition? For modification. Okay. So the purpose, the modification can, let me pull out the code because that will help me.
We should probably get this on the microphone so people at home can hear.
Yeah, and I want to have the code in front of me. Is it 8? There, okay. So conditions of approval have to be geared towards making the applicant move closer to satisfying the criteria. As Mr. Ramos mentioned, the applicant can agree to conditions through negotiation that the city and the applicant decide are worthwhile, but the city can't necessarily impose them unless they're intended to further the criteria of approval. One of the criteria of approval here at issue with the modifications is whether it better meets design guidelines, and the resulting development will better meet the applicable design guidelines. And the other criteria is the purpose of the standard. On balance, the proposal will be consistent with the purpose of the standard for which the modification is requested. And there is a lot of discretion in those criteria. Yes.
So strictly speaking, I mean, we've done dozens of these hearings, Mayor. The council can always say that we disagree with the Design Commission on any modification, or can say we are agreeable to certain modifications provided there is a parallel negotiation about other public benefits that we've identified as being compelling. We've done that repeatedly. Mr. Ramos's job is to make sure we stay in our lane.
Very good.
Is that a fair comment?
I would agree with that.
Good. That's very helpful, and I appreciate that clarification. Thanks, Commissioner. Thank you.
Mayor.
Yes, please, Commissioner Daly.
Thank you. All right. Bear with me. I have a few questions. I'm about to prove I had no ex parte contact because I have so many questions about this project. I just need a clear number on how much public space we're giving up. 3,000 square feet for the encroachment on the park. Anything on the plaza? I don't know if you actually gave the final number.
The plaza is 16,008, I believe, is in the exhibit that you have. And that was established through discussions with Design Commission as to how the measurement would be accomplished.
And that was the required area?
That's the standard.
That it meets the standard.
And the Festival Street, I love that name. Is that something that's planned or actually happening already? Are they using that street? I haven't been to that area for a while.
Currently, there is no street. Okay. It's a parking lot currently. Right. I think it's a driveway.
Okay.
It's more aptly, I think, termed as the alignment, the street alignment.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, absolutely. The design is shown to show flexibility, and also was some of the other guidelines in the master plan was to not to impact pedestrian connectivity, meaning, you know, there's safe harbor along the edges of the Festival Street for pedestrians and bikes, which we provided for. One of the things that, again, we looked to as we went to PBOT for some direction on Festival Street, and unfortunately, there is none. And so what we determined in going through this, and this has happened on other projects, is that basically the term I use is anything that's not built to a city street standard could be considered a Festival Street, meaning we call zero curbs, no conventional curbs, enhanced landscaping, larger buffers, interesting paving patterns, all those things could be considered part of a Festival Street. And we're not discounting the fact that that street could be occupied for a neighborhood event, although, you know, it would impact the residents, but that's something that could be managed very easily. And right now, the only vehicular access on the Festival Street would just be for access for the residents.
Okay. So just to be clear, the modifications would be the encroachment on the park, the not requiring a setback for that top floor, and allowing the penthouse amenity. Are those the three main?
I think that's a question better posed to Hillary to make sure that we're okay. defined on that. But
okay.
but those are some of the modifications that we requested and were granted. I'd also like to mention the technicality of the 47 feet is that we're allowed under Title 33 to have encroachment over 47 feet, which we always had in the building. And actually, we made sure that when we did do the 10-foot additional story height, we set that back. We moved that back to the west so that the idea is that we would not cast any more shadow from that club room than you would have from the parapet at 47 feet.
Okay. Can you, and I understand if you can't, but would you be able to give us an estimate of how many units you'd have to reduce the development by if you didn't get that 3,000 foot, the encroachment on the public park? Would you have to?
Yeah, we did run the numbers on a couple of different metrics on that. And again, I want to clarify something. When we came in with the prior design, we actually had stoops where we have live-work units.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point in time, we actually had 10-foot stoops extending out, which I hear the word encroachment, and encroachment usually conveys that it's going into a public right-of-way. And I like using the word encroachment here because it's really not. But
okay.
What we did was we actually removed 10 feet, and then we pushed the building over slightly. And actually, the net reduction over the prior design is actually 5 feet. I want everybody to hang on to that number. It's 5 feet because we actually had something that actually pushed out into that realm before. 41 units, to answer your other question. If we were to cleave off the edge of the building, we would lose 41 units.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit more about why retail was reduced?
It was not reduced.
It wasn't.
I don't know where that comes from, but and it's interesting. Again, I wish staff could talk more about this, but there are so many guidelines and so many standards that are buried and contained within the master plan, and in some cases, the guidelines and the standards are actually in conflict with one another. And so, interestingly enough, it doesn't really codify exactly how much retail in square footage is required. What it does say is you have to have 50 feet of depth, and the square has to have 70% active use. And interestingly enough, in the master plan, it does not address resident lobbies as meeting that standard. However, in a lot of the other urban jobs or projects that we do, that is considered active use. And actually, we were conditioned by my design commission, and rightfully so, to put a door, an entry off the plaza, as well as an entry off of the street to activate so the comings and goings of those residents who will be part of the neighborhood can come and go and meet and greet and be seen in the plaza.
And where will the public art be? You mentioned you're adding public art.
I'm gonna use my little exhibit here. Yeah. The connection here. Mm-hmm. There's a wall here along this unit.
Got it.
And we're proposing a mural. And actually, what we're proposing in the approved design was folk art that actually is a part of the existing service facility that's on the site that'll be raised.
So I would just like to comment that I do think this public square versus courtyard conversation is really important. I've actually been to the John Lennon Plaza in Barcelona. I've been saying that Amsterdam ruined me for cycling in Portland, and Barcelona kind of ruined me for public spaces in Portland because they're amazing. And, you know, it does sound like you are, by and large, following the letter of the law, but we want to make sure that the spirit is also there and that the space doesn't feel like that walking down the street, I wouldn't feel like an uninvited guest because I don't live or work in one of these spaces. So I think those concerns are legitimate, and I would just encourage you to consider thinking about how to make it truly welcoming. Obviously, the retail businesses are going to draw people in.
You know, Commissioner.
Well, and I would like to point out somewhere building closer to my neighborhood is called One North, and they had somewhat similar requirement, although I don't think that they were charged with creating a square, but there was an alley previously, you know, running through the lot, so they're required to give public access. Well, that space, if you want to drive by, does not feel welcoming to the neighborhood. I drove to work by this space for 3 years, and I don't think I ever saw anyone hanging out there. So if you want an example of, you know, maybe what not to do, you could look at that. No offense to anybody that might have had anything to do with that, but it just, for whatever reason, is not inviting the community in.
I was going to say that that issue was a central theme of the conversation before the Design Commission, and the team was sent back a couple of times to try to improve on just that question. And it might be available to you today to hear from someone from the Design Commission on that question, but that's been a critical issue of design from the start, and how to make this a square rather than just a courtyard. And that's been our goal. Of course, it's your judgment as to how successful we've been, but I think the Design Commission in the end felt that the right moves have been made to create that situation.
Thank you.
Commissioner Fritz. Oh, sorry.
Then, well, go ahead. Then,
thank you. I'm going to follow on with Commissioner Udaly's excellent line of questioning. You said that having the parking ramp off of the Festival Street might create some conflicts. It surely would create conflicts that if that's the only way that the residents can get their vehicles in and out, we couldn't have the whole thing being a festival, could you?
I'm sorry, is there a question?
The question is,
okay, the question is,
how would you envision that happening? If there's some kind of a street fair, but all these people need to get their cars in and out.
Well, once again, so that's for resident parking. I would envision that a management could basically inform the residents on a lot of streets that get closed, that the street was going to be closed for a certain time for a festival to occur, and to plan accordingly.
And how many units of housing are you proposing here?
We have 200 units of housing, but we're at a 0.5 parking ratio. So not all of these residents actually park in the parking structure.
So where will they park?
Well, we're hoping they'll take the public transportation that's going to be available to them.
Why did you put the parking ramp off of the Festival Street rather than off of 21st or Pettigrove?
They're restricted streets under the master plan.
Peabot.
And Northwest 21st is designated as a light rail street, so there would be no opportunity. And then additionally, There's been debate going back and forth about having a driveway crossing on Pettigrove. If we did have a driveway crossing on Pettigrove, then we would be hard-pressed to meet the other guideline requirements of the active retail.
Okay. What's this number, 44,014?
That's the entire blue area.
Okay, and how big is the square?
The square is 16,008 square feet, not including the breezeway or the arcade.
Okay. And when I'm thinking back to some of the great places in Europe, I'm thinking of St. Mark's Piazza in Venice, where at each corner there are accesses to get in, because it's not going to be obvious from 21st, which is one of the busy streets, that you look into here and there's not much to see, and then you're going to have to juggle around to be even able to see the park.
While there is no direct public access, at one time we did, I think the staff even said in one of our previous designs, we actually had a connection directly to Northwest 21st in the inside, what I call the inside knuckle of the building. However, Design Commission did not feel that that was the right answer, and that the idea was to push the building back and open it to the corner would be a better design solution. The other aspect of that is when we start to bifurcate the floor plan, we start to impact some of the other guidelines of the master plan, ironically, so that when you start to try to meet all of the percentages of the active uses fronting on the square, it becomes very difficult to meet all the metrics of that.
So how long is this, the private space here, which is for the residents to get out onto the square, how long is that distance?
The resident portion or just the entire length?
The resident portion.
The resident portion, it's probably about 65 feet of that length.
And that will be private? There won't be a right-of-way through to the other side?
That'll be for the residents. That is correct.
The 70 feet is quite a long way when you've got that amount. I'm just actually curious on some of the details here. Why have you specified it's going to be bike repair and a pet wash? How did that come up as the most urgent need in this neighborhood?
That's actually one of the amenities that's outlined in the master plan. What's really interesting about the master plan when they talk about the libraries and other public spaces is that there's also a provision in there, if I remember the master plan correctly, it actually gets you bonus FAR. And we did not choose to use bonus FAR. And we knew that we were trying to put retail in that back corner. That would be very difficult for us to make an active retail space. We know we need an amenity for the residents, and we decided to make that amenity for the residents as well as the public.
So there's presumably on this retail then there's entrances both sides. So there's entrance off of Quimby and there's an entrance off of the plaza.
That is correct.
Okay. How do those businesses get their stuff in and out?
Through the front door. Off
of the festival suite.
Off of Quimby. A front door loading.
So that would also be happening on the Festival Street in the event of
or it could occur off Northwest 21st because there's on-street parking loading there as well.
Well, except for this one here. What's the retail? It says retail trash here. How is the garbage collected from that then? Why is the trash there?
Well, at one point you do run out of space on plans for certain things like services. We tried to take and put it in a place where the retailers could actually get to. The idea is that the trash collection would be at the street. So basically those are contained in bins. And so the bins would be rolled out at time the trash pickup.
To where? Which?
To the street, to the right-of-way.
Which one?
Well, more than likely Pettigrove.
So everybody's going to be bringing their trash out there for the...
Yes, just like most of the downtown buildings are rolled out to the curb.
Yeah, it's a bit squished in here. Commissioner Saltzman has some questions.
Commissioner Saltzman, yeah. And then Commissioner Fish had a question from Parks, and then I'd like us to keep moving the hearing. We'll have plenty of opportunities to ask questions at the end. Thank you.
So I'm going to approach this on a much more global level. This project's been at it for 40 months, around 39 and a half, 40 months, so that's over 3 years, if I'm doing the math right.
It's over 3 years.
Okay. So there was, I think, Tim, you mentioned there was a three-person committee from the neighborhood who engaged in a three-hour meeting with you, the development team, I presume.
Yes.
And reached an agreement of sorts? Is that right?
The commission essentially at one point said, to get this right, let's appoint a subcommittee. And let's have that subcommittee of our commission meet with representatives of the developer and the neighborhood and see what could be done. And in that committee meeting, different design options were considered. I can say on behalf of the development team that we thought when we left the meeting we had a conceptual agreement with the neighborhood. We've been disabused of that idea since then. But that process took place, and a lot of trade-offs were considered. And the key, the configuration you see here is the product of that conversation.
So there was never a sign-off per se by the neighborhood?
No, I wouldn't want to represent it. Okay. They always had to go back to their board, of course.
All right. Okay. And then this is private land, right?
This yes.
is owned privately. So I guess, and I realize I'll ask this of the opponents too, but is it fair to hold up a John Lennon Square or a Pioneer Square or something like that, which arose out of public ownership and was developed under public ownership expectations of this is what a square should look like? Is it fair to take that same expectations and impose it upon privately owned property? This is purely an opinion.
Right. Yes, so I mean, the difference here is the way we're funding this square is as a part of a development project. So we have to be able to do the math and have a pro forma that shows that the development project can be successful enough to actually carry the weight of the additional investment in creating a public space. That's the challenge here. It's different than probably whatever happened in a medieval era in Barcelona.
Okay, thank you.
First, I just want to go on record as saying, having spent time in my my wife's family, beloved country of Spain, I actually think our parks stand up quite well. And I think the suite of parks we have in the River District are the envy of any city our size in this country or in Europe. But that's just one person's discretionary view. What's the status of the park to the east? When will that be built out?
Subsequent to our development being completed, they'll begin planning when we start construction.
And that will be pursuant to a robust public process for designing a public space?
That's what I understand, yes.
Okay.
I don't believe we have a development agreement for it yet, right?
Correct. Right.
All right. But that's an ongoing negotiation.
Parks has been involved the whole time here.
But there will be a park in short order once the development
yes.
is up and running. One of you gentlemen said that you're planning to have some folk art in the passageway between the building. I don't know what the rules are, but because I'm the council liaison to the Regional Arts and Culture Council, may I at least just suggest that if we're going to be doing public art in this area, and there will be public art, obviously, in the park because of our rules, how wonderful would it be to think about some connectedness with the public art so that it's not just some folk art here and something else there? And I would urge you to consider engaging the broader public in a narrative that links the two spaces. And Regional Arts and Culture Council does public art for the city. It would just be a shame if we're going to have an iconic plaza and a new park that the art was not speaking to each other, or wasn't at least someone wasn't actually thinking about the two. And so I would urge you to consider that. When I look at I'm still coming back to the space to the east of the building, which is there any reason why that could not be the future home of a festival if it was the intent to have some kind of outdoor event? It abuts a park. It's on a side of a building. It has pedestrian access. To me, it actually, with all due respect, looks more attractive than a street. Could that be festival? Could there be festival programming on that public space so that we're actually connecting it to something, i.e. the park?
There's no good reason not to do that.
Okay, other than the private developer could say no, but I mean, it seems to me, I agree with my colleagues. If we're going to have if the parking is the primary purpose of the what used to be called the Festival Way, I think we should be thinking about an alternative, and this seems to me to actually be a much more successful public realm for Festival. If we're talking about setting up a family-friendly event and welcoming people, because it abuts the building and the park. So, Mr. Ramos, is that a solution?
It makes perfect sense, and it would not. There would be no interference with the driveway access on Quimby to do that, and it has, you know, the great advantage of allowing people to spill into the park as a part of the festival, or if it begins to rain, to move the other way towards the square where there is some rain protection.
Well, for example, in the Fields Park, which was the last park that I had the honor of working on, we've created a festival way, if you will, a festival loop around the permeable surface. Mm-hmm. It's not my favorite configuration for certain events where alcohol is served, but it does bring people into the park and also provides an amenity. So I think we may have a solution, or at least a concept.
Yeah, it's reasonable. Yeah.
What's the width of that easement there versus the easement on Quimby?
It's 45 feet.
So that's 45, and what's Quimby?
60 feet.
And that's where we get into the encroachment into the park space, right?
Correct. And I believe PBOT has the conditions of approval spelled out in the staff report that we're to basically provide the easement full 45 feet and the full 60 feet on Quimby.
Very good. Thank you, gentlemen.
All right, thank you.
Opponents of the appeal, 3 minutes each. Carla, how many folks do we have signed up?
Four people.
Four, very good. And if anybody else wants to sign up, Carla's the person to see.
The first three are Julie Livingston, Homer Williams, and Sarah Bobian.
Come on up. Name for the record, 3 minutes, please.
Good afternoon, commissioners and Mayor Wheeler. My name is Julie Livingston, and I am chair of the Portland Design Commission. I have some very brief testimony this afternoon. So the Conway Master Plan document describes a phased development. Section 7 of the Conway Master Plan describes a phased development. Phase 1 is the grocery store, L.L. Hawkins, and the city park. Phase 2 is Block 290W, the block we're talking about today, and the remaining two blocks to the north that then constitute a super block that is the park, this development, and the two blocks to the north. So many of the issues that are relevant to this appeal layer into the assumptions around phasing of this super block. The site of the building sites, the size of the building sites, the access to below-grade parking, the development of the new city park. And as we now know, the phasing is not happening as the master plan projected that it would. Viewed through the lens of the master plan, there is some inherent compromise in the building being discussed today because the park is not yet complete and the two blocks to the north aren't part of this developer's current proposal. So Conway is under no obligation to sell parcels in the order described in the master plan. Nor is the developer of Block 290 obligated to purchase and develop the remaining parcels on the superblock. The master plan actually contains language that recognizes the difficulty of achieving a perfect rollout of the idealized vision. I'm quoting now from the master plan. Market needs, economics, and developer capacity will clearly influence the pace and viability of every parcel. As such, Conway cannot make any specific commitments at this time for the eventual placement, program, or timing of any of the individual parcels within the master plan boundary. So as you know, the Portland Design Commission assesses all buildings subject to a Type 3 review for compliance with the relevant design guidelines, and no building fulfills the intent of all guidelines perfectly. But it was the view of the commission with a 5-0 vote that this building was compliant with the guidelines that applied. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. My name is Sarah Bobian. I'm the Senior Director of Stewardship and Farm Engagement at the Tillamook County Creamery Association. As you may know, we are a 109-year-old cooperative in Tillamook, Oregon. You might be wondering why I'm here.
Can we start guessing? And the one who gets the closest gets a lifetime of cheese.
Yeah,
or something?
I was assuming it was to bring free samples of ice cream.
Surprise! While our headquarters is still in Tillamook, we have a growing presence in Portland. We just moved our Portland outpost from Tigard to the Slabtown neighborhood 4 weeks ago. Mm. We are currently leasing parking spots for our employees in Block 290. And while with the development, we'll be extremely challenged by the lack of parking in the neighborhood, we also realize it's critical to Oregon's future to solve the housing crisis in Portland and beyond. While I'm not an expert on squares or the master plan, we support buildings that are part of the solution to the housing shortage. With a range of rents, including the inclusionary housing for families earning 80% of the Portland median family income, the development provides options to Portlanders looking for stable housing, potentially including some of our employees. I don't want to be short-sighted, but it seems that the longer this process drags on, the longer it takes to provide this housing. As part of our Enrich Communities commitment, our objective is to provide social innovation and investment toward community resilience. The complexities of housing, planning, real estate, economics, and development are such that they eliminate a one-solution approach. It goes without saying, the central dilemma of our affordable housing challenge is that housing costs more than local wages and have the power to buy or rent. It is a wage problem at one end in the case of Oregon markets, a problem of strong demand for external equity and wealth on the other. Inevitably, it boils down to math. For us, affordable housing for our hourly workforce is our biggest concern. We frequently have more than 20 positions that we cannot fill because of lack of rentals. But stable housing for all Oregonians will lead to community resilience and a strong foundation for our business. We support the development for its voluntary focus on inclusionary housing, the public square for engaging the community, and the on-street shops to provide nearby services. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Homer Williams, Portland, Oregon. Mayor, commissioners, Commissioner Nick, it warms my heart to see you here.
Thank you.
And
I feel grateful for every day.
Yeah,
you
betcha. It's a little bit hard when you compare a park, the type of parks we're able to do in the Pearl or South Waterfront, where either the developer and city had significant parcels of land. And so as part of a larger planning process, whereas here, where individual buildings are being asked to do something, it does make designing buildings problematic. And I think that they've really done a very good job. If she can pull it up, I'd like to show you a similar plaza that we did with the Residence Inn.
It hasn't come through, so it might have been too big, I think.
Let me see here. Maybe you could just pass it around.
A number of us, I think, have had.
Phone might disappear.
If anybody has any long-distance calls they'd like to make, now's your chance.
Actually, I think a number of us have already had ex parte contact with this plaza.
And so what you have there, and frankly, we were very, very nervous in the beginning. And even had plans to where we could gate it. But it's turned out to be a great addition for the hotel. It gives them an opportunity to mix with people from the neighborhood. We've had weddings there. All kinds of events, not just from guests. And so I think that these can work really well, frankly. And in the early years, we would never have considered doing that in any of our buildings. Riverstone, any of them. I mean, we were so fearful of what might happen. But what we found over time was that these do work and they are safe. Now, you will have some issues like we're having right now because of the homeless situation, but generally it can be managed. And but I do think that it certainly opens up the neighborhood. And I think the idea of opening up to the park, participating in the kind of events that would take place, I think it's very engaging. So the only other comment I'd have is that if anything I've learned in the last couple of years is any nook and cranny anywhere we can find affordable housing, we need to get it. And we need to get as much of it as we can. So that's all.
Thank you. Thanks, all three of you.
Thank you. The last person signed up is Garrison Creamer.
Hello again.
Greetings.
Good afternoon. Garrison Creamer. I'm an infrastructural consultant. I took a look at this building, and I want to start off by saying I do agree that the seven-story limit is good. I think southern exposure is good as well. The no entrances, I believe it was on the north side, or basically there's two sides, I believe, that don't have entrances. Oh, man, that is very despotic, and that will be sure to bring depression to the area. I mean, architecture and vision. I'm a little disappointed. I mean, I came to Portland because I believe it's, you know, supposedly the greenest city in America. And, you know, the leading example of bicycles or bicyclism or whatever you want to call it in the nation. But from what I've seen, this town still ran on oil. If you go to the east side and you look back on the bank, you can clearly see that this town is moving towards more of a New York metropolitan model, although there are codes, supposedly, that keep it from doing that. Just take a. There's a difference between an open space and a negative space. Not all open spaces are negative spaces, but all negative spaces are open space. When I look at the design of this square and all this 90-degree rigid flat, it's very cold. And to me, this square that they're developing is an example of a negative space. Now, Mayor, I know you said that you have no financial gain from this vote, but I disagree with that because every time you take an action, it's a risk, which there's an opportunity cost involved. And, you know, anytime you vote on something, that could affect your future as a politician. So if you're planning on running for governor, this vote could, you know, have some type of financial gain. 30 seconds. Basically, before I got here, I watched a video on infrastructure and with the futures, and the question they asked is how ready is the infrastructure to accommodate the next level of mobility? Basically, what makes the city mobility, communication, and energy? And the main issues you guys are going to have are designing privacy and security in the future. And one quote was, some of the more aggressive mayors are looking at, how do I retrofit our current infrastructure? And I think, and I agree with them, that maybe it's more like, how can you be part of the change and make maybe more a shift towards experimentation? But I'm going to say I completely disagree with this. This architecture is despotic. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. We now have rebuttal by the appellant. If 5 minutes. Your mic may be off.
No, it looks like it's on. I'm just too far away.
No, I see Carla has to activate it. Very good.
And I'm only here because...